back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here in the third hour, we continue our conversation with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, talking about this ABC News report that aired last Friday on 2020 titled Resurrection, dealt basically from a number of different scholars all over the place, both theologically and geographically, on the historicity of the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. We continue that conversation, and we ask for your input as well, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Then in 25 minutes, Wesley Smith joins us to talk about what's been in the papers. New technique clones embryos for stem cells. It's out of Korea. We'll be talking about it in 25 minutes. Let's go to the phones and talk with Bob, who calls from his car. Bob, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Pastor Wilkin. Dr. Montgomery, I have a comment I'd like to pose in the form of a question. When was the last time a vision ever cooked you a fish dinner and then shared that meal with you?
That's a very good question, Bob. Thank you very much. He refers there to the latter chapters of John's Gospel, where Jesus appears apparently in Galilee after his resurrection to the disciples while they're fishing. Does this have the ring of a vision to you in any sense, Dr. Montgomery?
Hardly, and one can also take the road to Emmaus incident, where Jesus spends a good deal of time with disciples, and he eats with them. He interprets the scriptures in detail, and if one looks at the time between between Easter morning and the time he ascended into heaven, you've got numerous instances of exactly this kind of thing, where the detail is so specific that to talk about this as a dream or a vision is to misuse language.
Okay, another person, I would not necessarily call him a scholar, because we talked very shortly, not too long ago with you, Dr. Montgomery, after our interview with John Shelby Spong. Now, he was brought on to the ABC News report titled Resurrection for his opinion on what the resurrection was really about. But before that, here is his thoughts, John Shelby Spong's thoughts, on what the resurrection really was.
Shelby Spong believes there was a resurrection, but he doesn't believe it was physical. He, like many other believers, thinks it was a spiritual event.
You know, I think it's real. I think it took place in Galilee. I think Peter stood in the center of it. I think it has something to do with the breaking of bread. He was made known to us in the breaking of the bread. I don't know exactly what that is, but it is clear to me that there was something that opened their eyes to see a dimension of reality that I believe is beyond the boundaries of normal.
Dr. Montgomery, please decode the Spongese for us.
Well, yes. Bishop Spong desperately wants to make something out of the resurrection, and because he is an Episcopalian, he sees the Holy Communion in this, the breaking of bread, and some kind of an experience. But the fact is that having eliminated any historical reliability from the New Testament documents, there's no reason in the world why Bishop Spong should consider what he just said as having any relationship to reality. This is just a matter of wishful thinking. He really wants to make something religious out of this. But the fact of the matter is that the breaking of bread in some vague sense hardly is the equivalent of what has saved people across the centuries as a result of Jesus' de facto resurrection. Poor Bishop Spong, he really wants to have something in the middle of the mess that he's created theologically, but it's very difficult to understand why one should take that as having any more reality than everything that he's rejected in the case of the New Testament.
Anyway, Spong is engaging in sheer speculation, and he might even admit that he's engaging in sheer speculation. His best guess as to what the resurrection event really was, is that much different from the people who do have scholarly credentials, and we heard them there at the beginning of our conversation, who say, look, Jesus probably was buried in a mass grave for criminals, and the reason the women couldn't find the body is because they expected to find him in the wrong tomb. It was just a wrong tomb thing. Is that not equally just sheer speculation?
Oh, functionally, all of this is the same. And it all stems from a refusal to face the impact of the historical records. If one will do that, then all of this speculative nonsense disappears. But of course, the minute that you assume that these records are not saying anything that they are supposed to be saying, that they are nothing but the projections of rather weak-minded people and those desperate for religious experience, then you open up a Pandora's box, and it's possible at that point to speculate in a thousand ways. I mean, this makes me think a bit of Fandanikin in his Chariots of the Gods a number of years ago, 30 years ago, where Fandanikin said, maybe Jesus was a space person. Maybe he was a creature from outer space with special knowledge different from that of people here on Earth. Well, I mean, once you give up any respect for the primary historical records, why not? I mean, that's as good a speculation as any other, or turning it around, it's as worthless as any of the rest of them.
It might be a bit confusing to someone who watched the 2020 report on the resurrection, Dr. Montgomery, to hear Spong in the same breath deny the historicity of the resurrection as it is brought to us in the eyewitness accounts of the New Testament, but wanting, as you said, to make much of the resurrection event, wanting to speak very highly of this experience as something life-changing and powerful even to this day. How would you explain that to someone who says, you know, how can he do both?
It's a matter of wishful thinking. He wants to get something religious out of this. And what he gets out of it, of course, is what he puts into it. And it's very interesting that he will say there was a spiritual resurrection. There's a resurrection of a spiritual nature. And this is a common phenomenon among religious liberals. And why do they say this? They say this because nobody can define what a spiritual resurrection could possibly have been. The neat thing about the word spiritual is that it is a vague, undefined concept, and therefore it can be applied anywhere and everywhere, and it can mean whatever you'd like it to mean. That incidentally is one of the reasons why in Christianity, unlike other religions, there is so much emphasis placed upon the body, the resurrection of the body, Jesus' physical resurrection. This is because Christianity is not a spiritual phenomenon at all. It happens to be a manifestation of God Almighty come to earth to die for us in reality, and to save us in reality, and to take us to heaven in reality. It is not a matter of floating around in some sort of spiritual state of mind. This is not Buddhism, for goodness sake. It's not Hinduism. It certainly isn't the New Age. It's diametrically opposed to that kind of thing. There is the painting of the resurrection by, isn't it Picasso, who did a painting of the resurrection, I may not have the artist correct in this, but the cross is floating in air.
Oh, that's Dali. Yes,
it's Dali. Of course, it is Salvador Dali with mustache and all that. Not Jesus, but Dali, yeah. With mustache. Anyway, the cross with Jesus on it floats above the ground. All right. And many people think that that's a wonderful, wonderful picture. It has nothing to do with historic Christianity, unless the cross is firmly planted on the earth. Unless these events are specifically historical, then they are some kind of vague spirituality, and that's not going to do anybody any good in time or eternity. Jean Guiton, the French lay apologist and member of the Academy, who died just a few years ago, he told the story of a physician friend of his who said, "I can accept everything in the Apostles' Creed except he suffered under Pontius Pilate." Huh? And Guiton said, and that is the most fundamental heresy of all, because the point of the line, "he suffered under Pontius Pilate," is to ground this thing in historical reality, so it doesn't become a kind of vague spiritual mysticism of the Spong variety.
Folks, our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, is director and professor in residence for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. It's held each summer in Strasbourg, France. Now, if you'd like a free information brochure on the 10th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, that's for 2006 because 2005 is all full up. Simply call 1-800-737-0172. That's our resource line number, 1-800-737-0172, and we'll send you a free brochure, 1-800-737-0172, or check out the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Montgomery, if you would, for just a moment, explain to our listeners how this conference in Strasbourg every Sunday, every summer, equips lay people and pastors to do precisely the kind of thing that you do for us and our listeners on this program.
Well, in most churches, the Sunday school classes and the adult education classes attempt to deepen people's understanding of the scriptures and of the doctrines of the church, but they don't help to answer unbelievers' objections to the faith or provide the evidence in behalf of the faith so that we can confidently witness. And, of course, as the world gets more and more secular, there are more and more people with objections. That's understandable. I mean, these programs on television and radio raise all sorts of questions, and we hesitate often to witness because we're afraid that they will raise questions we don't have the answers to them. The purpose of the Academy of Apologetics, International Apologetics Academy in Strasbourg each summer, is to provide an intensive 2 weeks an analysis of the major non-Christian objections to the faith, and to provide the very best answers and to assist in communicating these answers. And it seems to me that that is desperately important. I think it's more important, maybe, than our coming to understand the exact meaning of 12 verses of the book of Hezekiah. Actually, there isn't any book of Hezekiah, but there we are. The point is that maybe if we spent a little less time in trying to become better internal churchmen, and we spent more time trying to impact the non-Christian society for Christ, the end result would be better. After all, our Lord said, go and preach the gospel to every creature and be ready always to give an answer for the hope that is within us.
Dr. Montgomery, a few minutes ago we heard from John Shelby Spong on the ABC News report, Resurrection, talking about what he thought the resurrection event really was, didn't bear much resemblance to the resurrection report found in the New Testament. Here's John Shelby Spong again, opining on what he thinks the resurrection was about.
I think they saw in the life of this Jesus this profundity of love that would not stop loving even when it was crucified. And that was the power that finally said there's something about love that cannot die.
Dr. Montgomery, is that what the resurrection is about?
Well, I don't see under the circumstances why we don't substitute the hero of Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. I mean, at the very end of The Tale of Two Cities, there's this wonderful, moving passage where Sidney Carton says, it is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. What he's doing is dying in the place of somebody else who is more worthy than himself. I mean, you can find innumerable examples in history of deeply moving situations of this kind. Why, under the sun, should we make Jesus the center of our lives and depend upon him for eternity if that's all there is to it? If all we have here is some kind of a model of somebody who could love even when he was being tortured and killed? I mean, that's reducing the Christian faith to a sentimental moralism. That kind of interpretation is not worthy in any sense of the word of the gospel of historic Christianity. Does any listener seriously think that the Christian faith could have transformed the Roman Empire and become the center of Western civilization if all that it consisted of at the heart is what Spong just said? I mean, It's utterly ridiculous. My goodness, you can hear that same sort of thing at the Rotary Club.
Folks, we have just a few more than 5 minutes left in our conversation with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery about the ABC News report aired last Friday on 2020 titled Resurrection, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Spong says that it's all about love. It strikes me that Spong is not the only one guilty. I think this often happens in Bible-believing evangelical circles where Easter Sunday presents the resurrection of Jesus Christ not as the thing in itself, but as a symbol of something else. At the end of the ABC News special, they had a montage of Spong and Bible-believing evangelicals all talking about the resurrection, ask what it means. The evangelicals say, it shows me there's an afterlife. It's about the power of life over death. It's about second chances, new beginnings, overcoming bad situations. It seems here that even among those who accept the historicity of the resurrection, they err in making it a symbol of something greater than itself. How would you respond?
Yes, I mean, this is not the Easter bunny. It isn't the spring flowers coming out at Easter time. The theme in the New Testament concerning the death of Christ and the resurrection is the main theme is that of Christus Victor, Christ the Victor. What he does on the cross is to conquer the evil powers arrayed against mankind. And the benefit of this is available to all those who recognize that they can't conquer those powers themselves and that they need desperately what he's done for them. What you have there is a cosmic event, and the consequences of that event are salvation to everyone who's willing to admit that he needs this and who will rely upon Christ for the benefits that come from the death and the resurrection. The thing is on an infinitely higher cosmic level than it's presented by either the religious liberals or many of the conservative evangelicals. I think it was Dorothy Sayers who said at one point that any novelist who is presented with the story of the God of the universe so loving us that he would come down to this messy little planet and actually take on the character of the inhabitants there and then allow himself to be killed and rise again in order to save them. Any novelist faced with that would have the theme of a lifetime. And said Dorothy Sayers, isn't it amazing how dull the churches have been able to make this?
Does it strike you as in any way surprising, Dr. Montgomery, be it John Shelby Spong or the other liberal scholars that we've heard as they were excerpted from the resurrection special on 2020, that once one cuts themselves loose from the actual eyewitness accounts of the event, how far afield one can go from the actual resurrection and what the disciples actually saw with their own eyes?
Oh, yeah, anything goes. If you cut yourself loose from this stuff, anything goes. And that reminds me of C.S. Lewis and the Screwtape Letters, where Uncle Screwtape advises nephew Wormwood to get the theologians to produce every fall a book entitled The Real Jesus. Screwtape says, of course, since the information on Jesus we've had for 2,000 years, and everyone knows exactly what that is, the only way that you can achieve this is by elevating information at one point and depressing it at another. But the object of this is to create, for example, this year a vegetarian Jesus, and next year a spiritual Jesus, and then a materialistic Jesus, and a communist Jesus, and a right-wing Jesus, left-wing Jesus, and all this and that. And says Screwtape, the object of this, of course, is to keep people away from the real Jesus. And this is very profound, because if one will go to the New Testament and simply put oneself at the disposal of that material, you know, shut up and listen, the character of Jesus and what he's done for us is utterly plain, absolutely clear. That's what the church has maintained for 2,000 years in all of its branches, as represented by the Apostles, Nicene, and Athanasian creeds. It's all perfectly clear. But if you begin messing with this stuff, if you begin raising some of it up and depressing other things and, you know, getting rid of this and emphasizing that because it makes you feel better, then, my goodness, there's absolutely no limit to this. There aren't any criteria available at all. The whole thing descends into nothing but subjectivism.
With only 30 seconds, Dr. Montgomery, someone has watched the ABC News special. They perhaps for the first time have heard someone question in a serious or less than serious way the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Is there any doubt about the authenticity of the records that bring us this event and not only the event itself but also all of the promises attached to Christ's death and resurrection for sinners?
The New Testament documents, as Sir Frederick Kenyon of the British Museum said a generation ago, are the most solid documents of the classical world, and the problem arises not from a deficiency of evidence, but from having so much good evidence. The fact of the matter is that if these documents cannot be relied upon, you can dump your entire knowledge of the classical world. You don't know anything about Greece and Rome. And of course we know plenty about Greece and Rome. What we're saying is that you've got to be fair to these documents and see them as having the tremendous historical backing and authenticity that they do have. Therefore, the more you go into the reliability of these documents, the more comfortable you're going to feel with them. I suggest F.F. Bruce's little classic, The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? Or go to my book, History, Law, and Christianity. There are any number of places that you can go so that you'll feel confident about those materials.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thank you for being our guest.
Always a pleasure.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he has authored and edited more than 50 books, including the one that he just mentioned, History, Law, and Christianity. Get that and other books by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Go to CILTPP.com. It is, by the way, the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy. Or you can call them at area code 780-461-3876, area code 780-461-3876. The book you want to ask for that he just mentioned, History, Law, and Christianity. When we come back from this break, Wesley Smith will join us to talk about something you've been reading about in the headlines. Two issues, stem cell research developments in South Korea, and we'll also be talking about a euthanasia case in England.
Nothing you can make, it can't be made.
But I think they saw in the life of this Jesus this profundity of love that would not stop loving even when it was crucified. And that was the power that finally said there's something about love that cannot die.
All you need is love. All you need is love. All you need is love. Love. Love is all you need.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Father's Day is coming up, and so is the 9th Annual Father of the Year Recognition Banquet, sponsored by Lutheran Child and Family Services of Illinois. I'm Phyllis Wallace, host of the Woman to Woman Show, and I'll emcee this event on June 3rd at the Holiday Inn Collinsville. Fathering in the 21st century is a challenge. Not that it's ever been easy, but today's dad can face one crisis after another, from job uncertainty to difficult relationships within his family. The East St. Louis Fathers Center is a community service program of Lutheran Child and Family Services of Illinois that provides job counseling and family support for dads. They invite you to join us June 3rd. Meet the Father of the Year. Be inspired by the insights and musical genius of Reverend John Nunes. Enjoy a mini auction, delicious food, and great company to support the Father's Center. June 3rd, Holiday Inn, Collinsville, only $40. Reservation deadline May 27th. More info, call 618-874-1701. That's 618-874-1701.
Children's books, but what's missing? Answers with Ken Ham, author of the children's rhyme book, D is for Dinosaur. Well, Ken, so tell us, what is missing from our children's Christian books?
Well, I was recently talking with one of our staff members who told me about a recent experience she had with her 7-year-old daughter. While reading a children's Bible, and when they got to the story of Noah's Ark, her daughter noticed something was missing. "But where are the dinosaurs, Mummy?" her daughter asked. You see, she had attended one of our Answers in Genesis seminars, and so she knew that dinosaurs really were on the Ark. After all, God created them when he created the other land animals, just before he created people. And she also heard from Answers in Genesis there was no death before sin, so dinosaurs couldn't have died out millions of years before man. You know, most Christians have been influenced by evolution, and they don't understand that the Bible gives the true history of the world, and that explains dinosaurs. And there's so much scientific evidence anyway that confirms the Bible's history. If they don't learn the truth about dinosaurs at home or Sunday school or church, where will children learn it? Sadly, it won't be from the books published by this popular Christian publisher. It's so important that children, teens, and adults be taught the truth of dinosaurs. It can greatly help them understand they can really trust God's Word.
You can help teach young people the truth of Scripture when you have them read our fascinating booklet on the Bible and the true history of the world. Ken Ham's free booklet is available on our website, answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. What's right for you might not be right for me. It's all relative, isn't it? At least that's the message we hear time and again in the media. Haven't we all seen characters on TV who claim that it is the height of arrogance and narrow-mindedness to think that you know the truth and those who disagree with you are wrong? But Bible-believing Christians do know the truth, not about everything, but about God and the love that He has shown us in Christ Jesus. We know these things because we know the Bible is the Word of God. Remind your children when they see TV characters floundering about in a sea of moral relativism, we Christians are different. We have the sure rock of Jesus and His Word to build our lives on. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 Tuesday on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. I'm not sure, but I don't think either one of us have particular green thumbs. But I know somebody who does, and he'll be with us all hours. So if you have questions about your plants, Chip Tynan from the Missouri Botanical Garden will be the guest for the entire hour of Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
A little bit later this summer, I'm going to be taking a very quick trip up to Fort Wayne, Indiana during Christ Academy 2005. They've asked me to do one day of lectures there for the high school-aged men who will be on campus for 2 weeks for this academy. One day lecture on, the Jesus of Culture. I had written something for the Life of the World magazine about 6 months ago called Everybody Loves Jesus, The Culture Cherishes a Counterfeit Christ. And I'm going to be doing a four-hour lecture that Saturday. I think it's July the 22nd, June the 25th, somewhere in that neighborhood, wherever Christ Academy falls. And I am but one of the lecturers there, far outshined by the regular faculty who will be sitting in class with these high school-age men, Larry Rast, Arthur Jest, Cameron McKenzie, others like that, in Christ Academy 2005, a two-week residential program for high school-age men. Plant a seed for the possibility of studying for the pastoral ministry on a permanent basis. Now, for more information on Christ Academy, you can visit, you can visit the website of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, ctsfw.edu. You can call, what's the number there, Jeff, for Christ Academy? Ah, there we go. Call 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. It's Christ Academy 2005. Or you can go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click on the Christ Academy 2005 logo. You will find all the information you need there as well. Wesley Smith is our guest in the last 25 minutes of the program. He joins us to discuss two issues, both in the news. There is stem cell research in South Korea that we need to discuss. Is it anything new? It's being touted as a new technique, according to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. an AP story, no, a New York Times story. And then there's also a euthanasia case in England that we'll discuss with Wesley Smith. He's a regular guest, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of several books, including his latest, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd. Good talking to you.
You're also going to be, I believe, one of the keynote speakers for the Lutherans for Life convention that's going to be held in November here in St. Louis, aren't you?
Will I finally get to meet you?
Yes, I'm going to be one of the plenary speakers for the same event.
Man.
Yeah, I think we'll finally get to meet.
Yeah, you know, I gave a speech in St. Louis last month, and I was hoping you would come, but I guess you couldn't make it.
I could not make it, and it was not a matter of not wanting to. It really was the case that I could not make it.
So, sure,
yeah, okay, well, we will finally connect at some point in November for the Lutherans for Life National Convention. I'm looking forward to meeting you, but also for hearing what you have to say there as well.
Well, thank you. I look forward to meeting you, too.
All right. Now, we have this headline, New Technique Clones Embryos for Stem Cells. It's from the New York Times, but it has to do with what's going on in South Korea. What's the story?
Well, it's not a new technique, first. It is somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. It is the same technique that was used to make Dolly the sheep. It has been now done successfully twice in two different batches by this particular South Korean researcher named Woo Suk Wang. So we are now literally engaging in South Korea and maybe in other places, the UK may have had a success too, in human cloning.
Okay, here's part of the story. You explain why they're saying it's a new technique. Here's part of the story. Until now, scientists had been studying human embryonic stem cells extracted from embryos created for that purpose. This did not involve cloning cells from specific patients. They had already obtained stem cells from embryos created at fertility clinics and donated by couples. Apparently, does this technique in South Korea involve cloning in some sense?
In every sense. In some sense. It's every sense. Cloning is the somatic cell nuclear transfer process. And that's where you take an egg, you take out the nucleus, you take a cell from, let's say, me, if you're going to clone me, you take one of my cells, say a skin cell, you take out the nucleus, you put it where the egg nucleus used to be, you zap it, and if the cloning works, you have a new embryo. This is called asexual reproduction. So there are now two ways to create mammal life. One is the natural way, sperm meets egg, which can be done in bodies after sexual intercourse, or can be done in petri dishes where sperm is mixed with egg and a fertilization occurs. The other way is a complete human invention called somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. And as I said before, that's how Dolly the sheep was made. Once the cloning is completed, what you have is a new embryo. At that point, there are no more efforts at cloning. You have a new human life, and the question then becomes, what do we do with this human life? What Woo Suk Wang is doing is creating this human life for the purpose of destroying it and extracting stem cell lines. Another potential purpose for those same embryos would be, as he has admitted in earlier interviews, would be for reproductive cloning, because the cloning technique is the same. The question is, what do you do with the life you have created through cloning? That is the somewhat false distinction that is sometimes made in the media.
So laying aside the considerable ethical problems with human cloning per se, the upshot of this story from out of South Korea is that human embryos will still be destroyed in order to get stem cells for research.
Well, and they will be made for that specific purpose. The embryos made in IVF clinics were not made for the purpose of being destroyed, but were made for the purpose of a couple having a baby. Now, the National Academy of Sciences, I need to point out, there was a great deal of news about a month ago where they came out with their supposed ethical guidelines that would now, you know, control the use of these technologies since the President Bush administration had not stepped forward to the plate, blah, blah, blah. Well, if you take a look at what the NAS supported, they not only support using embryos left over from IVF treatments, they not only support human cloning, which now some scientists, I've been testifying in various states, scientists are now saying, oh, that's not really an embryo because there's no sperm. I mean, it's just junk biology trying to fool legislators into thinking it's not a real human life, and it's worked with Governor Blunt, I'm afraid to say, in Missouri, who refuses to see that just like gravity causes the apple to fall off the tree, asexual reproduction with humans creates a new human life. Governor Blunt is being, in my view, obstinate in refusing to acknowledge that because he wants to maintain his pro-life credentials, and he wants to support cloning research. The third way the National Academy of Sciences now supports creating embryos is through fertilization. Remember, 4 years ago, we were told we will never create human embryos for use in research. We only want access to those embryos that are going to be destroyed anyway. Remember that? Well, those bets are off. We are now creating human life through cloning, and the NAS supports creating new human life through fertilization for embryonic stem cell research.
Here's a sidebar to the South Korea story. The South Korean announcement comes as Congress is poised to vote on expanding federal funding for embryonic stem cell research beyond the limited 22 cell lines approved in 2001 in his first term as president from George W. Bush. Another headline from the Nation section of this weekend's paper: Bush threatens to veto measure to ease stem cell research limits. What's the debate here?
Well, that has nothing to do with cloning. The Bush policy had to do with whether or not the federal government would fund the destruction of embryos for use in embryonic stem cell research. And what they always leave out of that story is that George Bush was following and obeying the law when he said, pre-existing law, when he said in August of 2001 that the federal government would fund embryonic stem cell research, but only with stem cell lines already in existence. And the reason he said that, in addition to his moral opposition to destroying human life for use in research, was something called the Dickey Amendment, which has been in effect since around 1996, which outlaws the federal government funding destructive embryo research. And this was before embryonic stem cell research was discovered. The reason Bill Clinton did not fund embryonic stem cell research, since embryonic stem cells were derived in humans in 1998, he had 2 years to fund the research. He didn't do it. And the reason he didn't do it was the Dickey Amendment. Somehow that always doesn't get mentioned in these stories about President Bush's policy.
The other story that you've joined us to talk about is out of England, and you start your recent column on this by saying the most important bioethics litigation in the world today involves a 45-year-old Englishman, Leslie Burke. Who is Leslie Burke? And what is this litigation?
Leslie Burke is a man who I met when I just did a one-week speaking tour of the UK, and I made a point of meeting Mr. Burke. Mr. Burke has a degenerative neural condition. It's similar to Lou Gehrig's disease. It's not Lou Gehrig's disease. It doesn't act as quickly as Lou Gehrig's disease, but he is slowly growing, progressively disabled, and may die from this condition. Leslie Burke is aware that in the UK, with their socialized medical system, there is, shall we call it, surreptitious healthcare rationing that goes on. And so, especially, I suppose, in light of the Terry Schiavo case, but he decided that he was really concerned that if he lost the ability to swallow, he would not be given food and water by his doctors. So he brought a lawsuit, and he's completely competent. I mean, I spent an hour talking to the guy. He brought a lawsuit in which he has asked for a court order that if and when he loses the ability to swallow, he will be provided a feeding tube rather than being dehydrated to death as a matter of protecting his right to life and his autonomy. Now, the trial court in England ruled in his favor, and you would think that that would be an uncontroversial ruling. But guess what? The General Medical Council, which is the medical licensing authority in the UK and which sets treatment guidelines for the National Health Service, which is the socialized medical financing system, joined by the Secretary of State for Health in the United Kingdom, has appealed, basically stating their view that whether or not Leslie Burke gets a feeding tube isn't up to him, it's up to his doctors, and that they have the right to make the decision based on their views of whether the treatment would be efficacious, meaning it would keep him alive, whether his quality of life, this is real dangerous, is worth preserving, and the resources that it would take to keep Leslie Burke alive. So now we see the true face of the bioethics movement coming to the fore. It isn't a, remember, Terri Schiavo supposedly died to protect her autonomy. That is, 20 years ago, she supposedly said if she were ever in a incapacitated state, she wouldn't want to be kept alive with tubes. Judge Greer said, oh, we must honor this this advance directive. We must let Terri Schiavo dehydrate to death as a matter of protecting her autonomy. Now you're seeing in the Leslie Burke case, the bioethics movement and doctors saying, wait a second, autonomy has its limits. If you want to live, you may not have that right. Unless people think, well, that's the United Kingdom, we don't have to worry about that here. Yes, you do, because right now in the United States, similar policies are being put in place in hospitals all around the country. It's called futile care theory, F-U-T-I-L-E. We've talked about this on this show, where doctors are being given the power to say no to wanted life-sustaining treatment if they don't think the, quote, quality of life of the patient is worth living or spending resources on. And in Texas, where a law permits futile care theory to be imposed on patients, we are beginning to see patients thrown off of wanted life-sustaining treatment, just like Leslie Burke is worried will happen to him.
So it sounds like a right to die, but not necessarily a right to live.
That's exactly it. If you don't want medical treatment to sustain your life, you don't have to have it, even if it means you will die, and I support that. People have the right to say no to unwanted medical treatment. But if you want your life sustained, well, we're finding out that autonomy has its limits. Now, if autonomy was the guidepost that we were so concerned about, this would make no sense logically. It does not compute. But it isn't autonomy that is the real bottom line here. It is that certain people should not be allowed to live when they reach a certain state of low quality of life. Once you understand that that's the agenda, then these two different approaches to autonomy make sense, because the issue isn't self-decision-making, it's death of certain people. We are being pushed toward a duty to die, Todd.
You say that this really comes down to two issues. One, and you've mentioned it here just in passing, the so-called quality of life ethic, and the other is just plain dollars and cents.
Explain. That's correct. Yeah, in bioethics, in mainstream bioethics, now of course there are certain bioethicists who don't agree with this, but in the mainstream view, the primary approach of the movement, which is really becoming an ideology, it isn't the sanctity of human life or the equality of human life that counts. What counts is the quality of life, and the lower the quality of life, particularly if you have a cognitive impairment, the less moral value you are deemed to have. And so we are doing away with the idea of universal human equality in bioethics and beginning to judge people by their state of disability or state of health. It's very dangerous, particularly for people on the margins. It's very dangerous for people who are disabled. It's very dangerous for people who are elderly. And it is very dangerous to people with terminal or very severe chronic diseases like Leslie Burke. This presents a real challenge to a society that is supposed to be judged by the way we treat our most vulnerable members.
One of the most chilling things in your column on this, Wesley, was when you said that you had privately discussed Burke's case with a prominent British physician, and you were chided by this physician saying Burke is only thinking of himself rather than looking at the bigger picture.
Yeah, I was really stunned by that. I don't want to name him because it was a private conversation and I wasn't interviewing him officially for publication. But this is a fellow who I've known of and admired and thought he would jump to Burke's support, and I was stunned that he had decided that, we can't let these patients tell us doctors what is in their best interest. I thought, whatever happened to autonomy here? He literally said, "Well, he's thinking of himself and not the bigger picture." My thought was, "Gee, how selfish of Mr. Burke to think of himself and not want to dehydrate to death." Gee, I was really taken aback, I must admit.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk first with Joe, who calls from his car. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Todd. I have to tell you, it always shakes me up hearing your current guest speak. It's really frightening. And hearing this today, it's frightening both personally and professionally. One, my wife and I have a handicapped child, and I mean, I fear for her what could happen to her when we're not there to protect her or take care of her, and what someone may decide to do it. Two, I'm an attorney myself, and I used to advise people anyway that you could put in your healthcare directive that you want all measures applied to keep you alive, and I guess I got to change that may not necessarily be true, or somebody, a court may decide, sorry, you don't forget to have all life-sustaining measures applied.
Well, I think you should still have them put it in the advance directive if that's what they want, because it'll be harder considering the efforts these people, the bioethicists, have put into pushing autonomy. But it's quite true that if you say they say they want it in an advance directive, they may not receive it. If this feudal care theory is able to be sustained by the courts. For example, in Texas, there's a feudal care case that's been pending now for a couple of months where it's almost the mirror image opposite of Terry Schiavo, where the wife is saying she wants a feeding tube for her husband who's in a persistent vegetative state because that's what he said he would have wanted, and a hospital in Houston said he can't have it. And the only reason this man is still alive is she was able to get a hospital in San Antonio to take her husband. Then that hospital said he can't have it, and now the husband's in a nursing home, so he's still alive. But that flies directly in the face of the whole concept supposedly behind the Schiavo dehydration. And with regard to your disabled child, it strikes me, and you're an attorney, so you know this, you need to be sure and name guardians in the event something happens to you who share your values that your child's life is as intrinsically valuable as anyone else's.
Let's talk with Miles, who calls from his car. Miles, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. First, I believe the Terry Schiavo case was definitely murder, and there were people that wanted to take care of her. There would have been no cost to anybody that wasn't willing to help her. But my question is the gentleman in England trying to compel the state to pay for his care? And I'll hold on if you want to ask me what I'm getting at.
All right.
Yes, the Mr. Burke is eligible for the NHS, and he wants to be sustained on a feeding tube. He thinks it's his decision, and the trial court said, as a matter of the EU Human Rights Charter, that it is his right to receive life-sustaining food and water. He is not asking for things like kidney dialysis or a respirator. He is merely asking for food and water.
Okay, well, Miles, and why do you ask the question, Miles?
Well, just because my own personal feelings about it, and I, you know, go ahead and scrutinize what I'm saying, please. But I don't feel like I have a right to compel anybody to take care of me who doesn't want to. I believe it is God's law that we should want to take care of people that are weak and poor. And so on, but I don't feel that personally I can compel anybody to do it, so I wouldn't feel comfortable trying to make the state or anybody else do it, except insofar as I already had an agreement that they would do it.
Well, right. Miles, thank you.
That's the issue here is that the National Health Service in the UK has stated that they will provide for the health needs of the population. They have not publicly started health care rationing. In fact, they deny their health care rationing. Yet their position in this case is completely to the opposite. If you're going to have health care rationing, then it strikes me it should be, if it's going to be imposed, it should be imposed through democratic processes in the open rather than this surreptitious kind of feudal care theory imposition that is threatened in the Burke case and is also threatened here in the United States.
You say near the end of your column on this subject, Wesley, it would be a mistake for us Americans to assume that we are safe from having life-sustaining treatment rationed like this just because we don't, at this point, have a National Health Service.
That's correct. But we have things called HMOs, which in a sense are corporatized, socialized medicine in a sense because of the managed care kind of approach. That is, these hospitals receive one fee for all the care you to receive. Therefore, the more care you receive, the harder it is for the hospital financially. And these feudal care protocols I just described are being put in place in hospitals around the country. It seems to me there should be a government investigation through the GAO to see which hospitals have them and how many have them, because nobody knows. There was a study here in California a few years ago which found that of 26 hospitals, I think, that were investigated, 24 had feudal care protocols in place, and all but seven of those gave the final decision about wanted life-sustaining treatment. And we're talking about treatment that would actually sustain life. We're not talking about treatment that wouldn't work, but which would work. All but seven of these hospitals gave the final say about whether a patient lived or died to someone other than the patient or the family. And that's really a potential catastrophe for people who are deemed to be expensive or deemed to have lives not worth living. We are moving into a eugenics pose that threatens the lives of the most vulnerable among us.
Wesley, we've got about a minute, no more here. Finally, you mentioned the term duty to die, and you won't hear very often the bioethics community talk in those terms, although it doesn't take a lot of parsing to figure out that's what they're saying. Is this the future of the brave new world of bioethics, a duty to die mentality?
Well, duty to die is something that is actually being discussed in the bioethics community. It has not become a majority view yet, but there's some very prominent bioethicists who have gone along with the idea that some of us have a duty to die, and implicit, certainly, in this feudal care theory idea, which is a majority view in bioethics, is a duty to die. That is, that some people's lives are so of such low quality that they have no business staying alive.
Folks, when you go home tonight, check out Wesley's website, WesleyJSmith.com. You'll find great resources on the issues surrounding bioethics, WesleyJSmith.com. Wesley, thank you again for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd. Anytime.
Wesley J. Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and he is author of several excellent books, including his latest Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Also this summer, a Confessional Christian Worldview seminar. This is one of those events that allows the student of God's Word and of God's world to examine, well, for instance, science in the light of a Christian worldview. It's a Confessional Christian Worldview seminar this summer in Trago, Wisconsin at the Schwann Center. For more information, call 1-800-577-4848. 1-800-577-4848 and ask for a free brochure on a Confessional Christian Worldview seminar this summer in Trago, Wisconsin, or go to our website, issuesetc.org. Look for the Schwann Center logo there on the homepage, and you'll find information as well. 1-800-577-4848 for a free brochure on a Confessional Christian Worldview seminar. Tomorrow on the program, well, we played it for you at the beginning of the program today. We'll replay our interview tomorrow with Joyce Meyer. We talked to her earlier about her book, Overcoming, Approval Addiction. And we'll be replaying that interview for your reaction tomorrow. Also tomorrow, we'll talk with Pastor Clement Preuss, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff, about the dynamism of American Christianity. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.